Blog Talk Radio.
And welcome to Web Sleuth Radio, my friends. My name is Tricia Griffith, the owner of WebSleuth.com. And tonight we join once again the filmmakers of The Killing Season on A&E, Josh Zeman and Rachel Mills. We have a lineup of guests unbelievable. John Ray, the family attorney for the Gilbert family, he'll be on with us, and he's got some very interesting things to share with us. Linda Cohen, she is a reporter for AtlanticCity.com, and she knows the Atlantic City cases inside and out. And then we have crime profiler John Kelly, who's going to talk about the reward. But right now, let's go to Josh and Rachel. And this is the second week they aired episodes 3 and 4 on A&E, and things have just been moving right up until showtime. Things are really happening, aren't they?
Yeah, you know what? After the first two episodes aired, we thought that maybe less people would watch on this Saturday, mm-hmm. this past Saturday, and more people have been invested into these cases, not just Long Island, but Atlantic City, which we got into in episode 3, you know? Mm-hmm. So we continue to go down further and further into that rabbit hole, you know?
And there's so many areas to... Oh, I'm sorry, Josh, go ahead.
No, it's you know, we were hoping to get this kind of response, and it's great to see. You know, our goal has always been to kind of push the story forward, to get people talking. And from that, I mean, listen, we know how this works, right? The more people we get talking about it, the more information, the more reporters, the more chances we have of getting some kind of answer. And I'm happy to report that that is happening. You know, I think we'll share with everybody what is exactly going on. But, you know, our work isn't done, obviously. And so this is just step two of a much longer and larger process to finding some answers.
So we have 4 more episodes, 2 more weeks. And there's a lot that's going to be uncovered that I think is that's really going to surprise a lot of people. But since last week's 2 episodes, there have been so many questions, again, about Shannon Gilbert and the Gilbert family. And that's why I'm so glad we're going to have John Ray, the family attorney, on to answer some of those questions. And would you like to just take one question now that everybody has been emailing me about real quickly? And
sure.
This comes from the burlap bags. Everybody seems to have a theory on the burlap bags. Are they really that big of a clue, and have you ever really truly discovered where they came from?
That is a great question. Let me just say that there's a couple things, and the burlap may be even more important than we realize because of this. So, number one, the burlap was never released, you know, to the public. It was accidentally released. We don't know where that accidental release came from. We think we now know that a detective released that information to someone at the New York Post. That reporter has since passed away. But that was a holdback, we think, now. That was released. And seeing that it was a holdback, the question becomes, how important is it? And the answer is very important. The question is, was there some identifying marks on the burlap that would indicate where it came from? People have said, and everybody's got theories, right? It's a clammer.
Right.
You know, it's a clammer. It's a fisherman.
That was my next question. Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead.
People are saying, I haven't heard anything about the seafood. You know, I'd order clams for a clam bake, and they come in these big burlap bags. Could it be a fisherman? That's another big thing that everybody's talking about. There's nothing to say that it isn't, but who knows?
Well, look, we know that law enforcement checked the, you know, obviously that area is a fishing area. There's even oysters that are harvested right there. So that is something that got people very interested. At the same time, the landscaping thing does make sense. I mean, look at Joel Rifkin. who was one of the most prolific serial killers in all of New York State, if not Long Island, lived 30 minutes away. He was a landscaper. So the landscaping thing is big, and that's why we went and we looked at Bissett. But again, just because Bissett, you know, owned a big company that sold burlap doesn't mean he's the guy. Now, what's very interesting is we went into that facility, and they didn't just sell one type of burlap. They sold like 25 different types of burlap.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we're very interested about some markings that were on the burlap. The police are not going to reveal that information. But there's something else that came out of our show. You may remember Khalil, who is mm-hmm. the boyfriend and was the, you know, the pimp of Jessica Taylor. In the show, we say that he tells us that Jessica Taylor was found wrapped in burlap. Now, he doesn't mean Jessica Taylor was found wrapped in burlap along mm-hmm. Gilgo Beach, because he was not re-interviewed by the Suffolk County Police a second time. Now, that raises an incredible question. How could Suffolk County Police not re-interview the boyfriend slash pimp of Jessica Taylor once she was found a second time on Gilgo Beach? I don't know how that can happen, but regardless, he wasn't. He says that police told him Jessica Taylor was wrapped in burlap back in 2003 when she was found in Manorville. If that's the case, then that changes how we look at this case. That would mean that Manorville and is connected to the GB4 via the burlap, and it becomes one killer. We didn't quite believe that. You know, a lot of things investigators talk about is like, they want to say when you have a theory, you have to make sure that you're not manipulating the facts to fit your theory. And we kind of disregarded Khalil because we didn't think that that pointed to two killers. Now we have to go back and we have to say maybe it is one killer if Khalil says he's remembering correctly. And Khalil emailed Rachel, correct, Rachel?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I got a Facebook message. Yeah, I got a Facebook message from him from 2 days ago. He watched the show, and he said, "Hey guys, like what I told you was exactly what police told me." Because, you know, to be quite honest, both Josh and myself were like, maybe he's misremembering, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, no, absolutely not. This is what police told me, and I wouldn't make that up. And he added on to that, like, every day he thinks about Jessica. You know, he has a new girlfriend, and he's like, she's the love of my life, you know. And it's really important for me to make sure that what's out there is exactly what I've been told. So, you know, to hear from him and for him to say, you know, like, absolutely not, like, I totally remember, we have to go back and kind of look at that, you know?
Totally.
Right.
We're not done with that thread. You know, I'm like, okay, well, who is the detective? He doesn't know who the detective was. We looked, we searched the telephone number. Telephone number no longer works. But we need to reassess that. But if it's true, if Jessica Taylor was really found wrapped in burlap in Manorville, that totally changes at least how I view this case.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have an update on
that. And how do you view it?
Well, I view.
You don't want to elaborate
viewed,
right now?
Sure, I viewed from Peter Brent's account, and it made sense to me that it was two different serial killers based upon two very different signatures.
Mm-hmm.
One is a dismemberer, and he's not dismembering necessarily for identification purposes. He's dismembering because, you know, it's more than that. And without getting into the gory details, the point is he's dismembering before they're dead, rather than post-mortem dismembering.
Oh, no, awful. That's just so awful to even think about.
Right.
Ugh, I can't imagine.
Now, he is dismembering heads and hands. So, yes, he is preventing identification, but because of the way that the body of at least Jessica Taylor was displayed, she was, like, found. We've been there. You know, it's very close to the road. It's kind of out in the open. It wasn't hidden like the GB4 were. You know, the GB4 were thrown, were in the brush. It would be wicked hard to find them in that brush. Jessica Taylor was not like, wasn't like that. She was kind of, as Peter was saying, displayed, and that gave this idea of this kind of, you know, he wants people to find it, much like we went into the Jack the Ripper thing where, in the Whitechapel murder, basically put a body part in Scotland Yard. I mean, he knew the police were building a police station, and he put it there as an FU to them. So we thought that that was the case here. Maybe it's not. I mean, so when we say that things are happening as we speak, they are. It's all unfolding right now.
They truly, truly are. Truly are. And that's what makes this so exciting, because as people get more interested and as more clues come up, you just got to have some hope that something is going to happen that's going to turn this case around, and we're finally going to get some answers. Could I ask one more question about Shannon Gilbert? We have a lot of people wanting questions about Shannon, and I'm saving most of them for Mr. Ray, but were they able to do a tox screen at all on her remains?
Ha, good question. Rach, you want to take it, or you want me to?
I think you should take that. You should take it.
Okay. So, yes, they were able to do a toxicology report, but she'd been skeletonized. And there's only so much that you can get in that respect. And that was a big thing for us, because if the toxicology revealed cocaine, you know, MDMA, or even, you know, drugs that she may have been taking for bipolar, that would lend credence to the she had a freak out, you know, theory. Or maybe drugs that, you know, some surmise that Hackett may have given her. You know, listen, there's another thing that we don't even discuss that we should have, but look, guys, we only have so much time in our episodes, you know what I'm saying? Which is the fact that it was told that running out of the house, of Brewer's house, she fell and hit her head. And numerous people have said she fell and hit her head. When I say numerous people, Brewer and Michael Pack. Also, one reason why the earring may have been on that ground right there at that moment, the earring that one of the sisters then later found. You know, it's not out of the question. It happens all the time. People hit their head and, you know, they, I forget, a subdural, I don't know what it's called, but, you know, they basically...
Subdural hematoma, where they get the blood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, it happens. It happens to, like, football players, you know. And so, interestingly enough, that is one of the things that Hackett had surmised in some conversations to at least maybe the family. I don't know where he did, but I read that he had maybe said maybe that's what happened to him. So, look, Shannon, we're still finding out information. And one of the biggest pieces of information that we're still finding out is the 911 call. And this goes back to the same thing.
Right. Let's talk about that. Right.
Right. So, look, I'm going to reveal something to the audience, you know, that's interesting about the show. We go back to Long Island. And there's damn good reason we go back to Long Island. And so that story is not over yet for those people who think we just kind of leave it and move on. It's not by a long shot. And so we'll get back to that, but I do want to stick with this 911 call because it's very important information, and we pushed law enforcement, Suffolk County, to reveal it, and they won't. And it is a mystery as to why. And as we know, especially in this forum, mystery leads to speculation. So
Oh yes.
We're Is John Ray on? Are we going to get him on?
Yes, he is. We are ready. Let's bring Mr. Ray on. We have with us tonight, we're very glad he's here with us, John Ray. He is a family attorney for the Gilbert family, for Shannon Gilbert's family. And Mr. Ray, welcome to Web Sleuth Radio. You're on with Rachel and Josh, and I will just turn it over to you three.
Okay.
Hey, John.
Hi.
Hey, John.
Josh. Hey, Rachel.
Hey. So thanks for joining us today, and you and I have had some conversations offline very recently about the 911 call and about the tape and getting that tape. Can you tell us a little bit of the history that you've had in trying to get this tape made public?
Yes. it's a 21 or 23-minute tape, depending upon who you speak with, but I've asked for it via a Freedom of Information request. That was denied, and a judge on that case, we went to court to compel the county to give us that tape, and they fought it. And the judge in that case said we cannot get the tape by a FOIL, that is a Freedom of Information request. Instead, we can get it by subpoena. But we had already subpoenaed the tape, and in front of a different judge, we have that case pending to get the tapes that way because the county refuses to give them up. And in that case, which is pending, we are asking under the subpoena for the tapes, all the 911 tapes from that morning of May 1st, 2010. Now, the county is resisting that. Claiming that the tapes are subject to an open investigation of Shannon's death. That's a contradiction to their position that Shannon died by natural causes. So we think that there's something on that tape we need to hear.
Now, just to clear it up, the police have said, what is their official stance on Shannon's death? How do they officially rule it?
The police have not taken an official position that I can discern with certainty. The medical examiner, who's a different entity of the county government, said that the death is undetermined. The cause of death and the manner of death are both undetermined. Dr. Michael Bodden, a very well-known, internationally known coroner, said that the death was consistent with strangulation. The police have said, depending upon when, they said before they even found her remains that she died of drowning. Then when her remains were found, that she died of natural causes by exposure in the marsh. We've heard nothing after that since their position on that. But so I don't know what their position is at this point.
Is the case considered open or closed?
The case by the police in court is considered open. But not really. I mean, nothing has happened that I can discern from the vast amount of investigative work we've done here that the police have done anything to advance the case since about 2012.
Right. Mm. So correct me if I'm wrong, but with the police chief, Commissioner Dormer, correct, saying previously that he believes it was drowning, that he believes it was natural causes, just because the police commissioner says it doesn't mean it's the police department's official stance. Is that correct?
Well, it probably does mean that it was their stance when Dormer was the commissioner because he speaks for them. But he's no longer the commissioner, probably in large part because of this case. So what is their police position since then? Only that it's an open investigation and that they are cooperating with the FBI to look into the entire Oak Beach / Gilgo Beach matter. That's the official position that I know of. So nobody has said definitely, the police have not said definitely that girl died of natural causes, that girl being Shannon Gilbert. Mm-hmm. They just haven't said it. So after Dormer.
Then if you can explain to me, what is the legal precedent if the police are saying that the case is open for you to say that this 911 call should be released if they are saying the case is open?
Yeah, what happens here is that under the subpoena, the police, we issued a subpoena saying we want these tapes in our case, the civil case I brought against Dr. Hackett.
Right.
And the police resist that by saying it's an open criminal investigation. Therefore, we don't have to release our evidence. The problem with that position for the police is simply this, that some, just about only a year ago, January, a decision came out from the appellate division in our jurisdiction that records ordinarily in such matters are releasable when they are subpoenaed in a civil case. And we're relying upon that decision by the appellate division, which was made against Suffolk County, for us to say that we should get these records, and asking the judge to give us these pieces of evidence, namely the tapes. So that's the official position we have. That's the official position the police have. They're saying, well, it's an active investigation. The judge should not allow it to be released. We say that the law says they have to allow it to be released. However, when you think about it, the police are saying they can't release that, yet they've released enormous amounts of other evidence in the same case, which they claim is not even necessarily a murder. So the police position is self-contradictory in every way. And we can't understand why. I mean, other than that there's something on those tapes that they don't want us to hear.
And let me ask you a question.
What else can there be a reason for to resist giving us the tape?
I agree with you there. Mary Gilbert heard the tape, correct? It was read to her.
No, Mary Gilbert did not ever hear the tape. Mary Gilbert and I heard what was on the tape from hearsay, from the medical examiner, the assistant medical examiner, who revealed to us what she said was on the tape. And what she said was on the tape is in direct contradiction to what the vice president of the Detectives Association said was on the tape. And so
those two different positions?
Yes. The medical examiner told us, and when we went for the family meeting with the medical examiner to discuss Shannon's death, that on the tape she heard that Shannon said, "They're trying to kill me," and also that Shannon was very excited and upset, and that there was a scuffle. Joe Brewer's voice appears on the tape, and Michael Pack's voice appears on the tape, as well as Shannon's, obviously, and never said whether anybody else's did or not. However, she says there's an excitement and a scuffle. Detective Stephan, who was in the investigation himself, writes me a letter, which he later publishes in Newsday, in which he says that at all times Shannon was calm. Those two statements contradict one another, and that would lead you to believe that there's a problem with the tape. But I mean, just as equally as important is this problem, since they gave back the cell phone of Shannon Gilbert to Shannon's mom, they've done nothing to acquire some of the other evidence in the case whatsoever. For example, the computer and the cell phones of Shannon Gilbert, they've given back to Dr. Hackett his notes in the case. Yet they withhold one piece of evidence, the tapes. It makes no sense unless there's something on the tape that they do not want us to know. There's no other way to describe it.
Can I read you something? A gentleman by the name of Crowley, he was a New York Post, Daily News, writer. The same gentleman, by the way, who revealed the burlap, which was a holdback, which then became public information. This is Kieran Crowley. Wrote on 12/15, quoting Mary Gilbert, "We all heard the last 911 call. Gilbert's mother, Mary, told the Post at her home in upstate Ellenville. Shannon was screaming the person's name and saying, 'He's trying to kill me.' She was saying, 'Help me, help me, help me.' Was that name Joseph Brewer?"
That's the first I've heard that, and If Kieran, who's a reputable reporter, was a reputable reporter, he's passed away.
Yes.
But if he's quoting Mary, Mary did not get that information from the police. And I was there when the discussion, which I wrote down in detail, took place with the medical examiner. The only time this tape was discussed with Mary Gilbert that I know of, and nothing like that was on the tape.
Is there any difference between asking for a transcript of the tape and the tape itself? Do you believe that if you ask for a transcript, they would give you the tape?
No, they would not. In fact, the lieutenant in charge of the investigation, the more recent lieutenant, has said that it was would be over his dead body that I would be given the tape. And I don't know why that would be so. You know, we're waiting for the judge to decide on this issue.
Yeah.
And we expect that decision fairly shortly. But even if I get the decision, they'll likely appeal it.
Right.
Why? Why are they fighting so hard on something that you would think is incidental if there's nothing on it? If there's nothing on it other than what we already know, there's no reason not to give it to us. If there's something on it which we should not know, there's every reason for us to get it.
Understood. Listen, it's a compelling argument as to why. And if it's not, it just fuels the conspiracy theories as to what's going on.
Yeah.
But, you know, at this point, are they conspiracy theories or not? You know, now I question it, you know, and so.
Well, what's a conspiracy? Any two people talking together about something and covering it up is a conspiracy.
Okay.
Most things have conspiratorial aspects to them. Most crimes do. You know, what's the level of the conspiracy, the extent of it is really the better question, not whether there is one. The only way there is no conspiracy if there's a single killer who never told anybody, never involved anybody. And that's very unlikely.
Good point. Let me ask you another question. where are we in terms of getting that tape released?
Right now, we have pending before a judge our motion to compel the release of the tapes, the county's motion to quash our subpoena, to stop it. That judge has had that case before him for several months. I believe he's going to decide it within the next few weeks. One of the things, the glitches that got in the way was Mary's death, which then eliminated the administrator to the estate that was suing Hackett. So we've cleared that up because I've gotten Cherie Gilbert, the sister of Shannon, appointed as a co-administratrix in the estate. So we're moving forward with it, and we're hoping the judge will decide. That's where we are.
Now, we've asked Cherie to be on. Rachel, you've been in communication with Cherie, correct?
That's correct.
And I guess she decided not to. I don't blame her.
Right.
You know, the tragedy, it's been very tragic, what happened to that family. I don't want to take away from what may or may not have happened to Shannon. But at the same time, I do want to bring up a little bit of a question. And so you are now representing her sister,
right?
Correct?
Yes.
And can you tell us, you know, listen, you know, and the press is, it's been very clear. I mean, she's mentally ill. She was schizophrenic, correct?
We're raising an insanity defense for a long-term schizophrenia. That's as far as I can talk about Sarah and her murder case right now. That's our only defense, and it is a strong one.
Is that defense being challenged at all?
Yes, the district attorney in Ulster County is insisting upon a conviction of murder. So
really?
We're therefore resisting that. You know, with the usual things that lawyers do with these cases. But I've already agreed with the judge in that case and the district attorney that I would say no more than that Shannon's sister, Sarah, her defense to her mother's slaying is that, you know, Sarah is schizophrenic and that she is raising an insanity defense. There's a lot more to the case, as you can guess, but I can't discuss that part of it.
That's fine, and I appreciate that. But you can discuss the facts. Would you ever institutionalize before this event?
I promised the judge I wouldn't go into it, but she has a long history. She has a long history.
Right, and look, you know, I don't want to play armchair psychiatrist. That would be the wrong and irresponsible thing for us to do. But if you read some of the facts out there, we've been reading a lot of the literature about how schizophrenia happens in families. Schizophrenia among sisters, brothers and sisters, high level. We do know that Shannon was bipolar. That's been widely covered in Bob Coker's book. And so,
well, that's just hearsay.
Know.
That's hearsay. And well, Bob Coker's book is based on, and that issue is based on strictly hearsay. I've actually investigated Shannon's psychiatric history, and largely there is none. So that's just speculation. That's just not true. I mean, but there's no evidence of it.
Okay, it may be true. There's just, you just don't have evidence of that.
There's no evidence of it. It's just speculation.
So we don't know. But it could be
it's her boyfriend said that. Her boyfriend used that word. Her boyfriend, you know, he has no axe to grind in the case. But you know, there's she was never admitted into any rehab in New Jersey for any kind of psychiatric or drug or other issues whatsoever. And I have that because we firsthand investigated that.
That's fine, but I think it's a legitimate question that may go against your theories or some of my theories, and you know, we can discuss that. But I think, you know, there is some question, and I think there's some legitimate question. I don't think we're done on that issue, but well, listen, as you know, we've been one place where we are aligned is in wanting the release of that 911 tape to clear up some of these issues.
I guess so.
We wish you the best of luck in doing so, and we want to support you in any way you can in getting this 911 call release. Is there anything the general public can do in helping you get that 911 call release?
Not the general public can't do anything with the court, because courts are supposed to decide things in the cold light of the law. And any public pressure brought upon a court would be improper. However, pressure brought upon the police department to voluntarily release the tapes to us would be valuable, because they might be willing to do that at some point. You know, I've been willing to cooperate with the police throughout this whole investigation, and they even agreed to cooperate with me. Their head of their investigative force did so, and they never have actually cooperated at this stage. So maybe a little pressure from the public on the police department would be helpful. However, pressure from great public pressure from various things, such as Dr. Michael Bodden's finding that Shannon's death was consistent with strangulation, has not moved the police to give us that tape. Now, I also have a record that the police sent to us in response to our repeated FOIL requests, which we've put upon them from various sources. Mm. Various different people have made FOIL requests, Freedom of Information requests, from the police department for those tapes. And their answer lately has been that the tapes were scheduled to have been destroyed in 2015. And so we wrote to them saying, have you destroyed the tapes? And they have refused or failed to answer us.
Interesting.
So I have a strong suspicion that the tapes may not be in the condition or in the place where they should be at this point.
If those tapes were destroyed, knowing how sensitive they were, I would feel upset, to say the least.
So
listen, we wish you the best of luck. I
wish you the best of luck. I think you're going down the wrong path in the wrong way, if you want my personal opinion, just like you told me. I think you've missed a huge amount of evidence that's sitting right there in Oak Beach, just like the police department has. And if you would study it and take your time and do that, your view might be different. I don't think you're going to find the killer in Daytona Beach or in Atlantic City. You're going to find him right in Oak Beach.
Okay.
But that's my view. Your view is different. We don't agree.
Well, let's go to the end of the series, and then.
Okay. Well, I'll change that. Listen, you've done a very fabulous job, both of you, in working so hard on this. I am impressed with the diligence that you have, and in fact, you've uncovered some great things. But you know, so have we. So let's see where we go.
Mm-hmm. Let's see where we go. Okay. Well, excited. We are definitely going to be coming back and discussing this. Right, Trish?
Okay.
Absolutely right. And Mr. Ray, I do have some questions from some of our Web Sleuth members. If you have a few moments, I'd like to pass those along to you.
Sure.
Did Hackett, now Dr. Hackett, he's quite the character, did he take a police polygraph or an independent polygraph or any polygraph at all? And if he did, know the results.
He refused a polygraph offered by the Suffolk County Police Department, and he claimed that he wouldn't be able to pass it because of the medications he was on. So, and upon the advice of his attorney, so he did not ever take a polygraph test.
Do
so
you
polygraphs
believe
are still
that?
Admissible in court, correct?
Pardon me?
But polygraphs are still admissible in court, correct?
The polygraph is not admissible in a court in New York,
mm-hmm.
Absent everybody volunteering and agreeing to it being admitted. But even then, it has very little weight anymore. Look, polygraphs in more than 99% of the cases are very strong and accurate. But they're only accurate as to the questions which are asked. So if you don't ask the right questions, what value does it have? And the police made this offer to Hackett early on in the case. And so I don't know, you know, he refused it even early on in the case, is it significant? Well, that's for you to decide. It's very consistent with Hackett's behavior throughout the whole case.
Okay.
Still a couple more questions, if I may, if that's okay. In general, any new insight on calls Hackett placed to Mari Gilbert? Anything else we know about it? Have we just anything else come up?
Yes. Hackett made three calls to Mary Gilbert from Monday, May 3rd, 2010 until Thursday, May 5th, 2010, or May 6th, rather, 2010. They were lengthy calls lasting 4 to 6 minutes. Hackett denied that he made them to the public. He admitted under oath that he made them. The calls were made from his cell phone. I have the records. The police have never requested those records. I have them. But in any event, he admitted the calls. He changed his story about why he made the calls in various ways at various times. None of them make much sense, his explanations of why he made those calls. But another interesting fact has developed on those calls, and that is that Hackett has 4 cell phone numbers. Belonging allegedly to his family. He claims that one of his cell phones belongs to his son. On May the 1st, 2010, at 3 o'clock in the morning, a cell phone call was made from his son's phone to a place in Kingston in Ulster County, which is where Ellenville is located, where Shannon and her family lived. And there's actually 2 calls made at a bizarre time in the morning. So we're now following that fact. So that's
interesting. That definitely is. Do you know, and this is perhaps a question for Josh and Rachel as well, Mr. Ray, why wasn't Shannon's driver, his name is Michael Pack, was he investigated at all, any thoroughness?
The police investigated him initially, and he allegedly took a lie detector test and passed it. Depending upon the questions asked of him. I interviewed him for over 45 minutes by telephone early on when I first came into the case. And Michael Pack's involvement with the police was fairly minimal. The homicide squad did not spend a lot of time with him, but they already wrote him off as not being a suspect in the case.
And logically so, right? I mean, why would a killer drive his... charge all the way there and do all this. I mean, it just doesn't make sense.
There are many good reasons to believe he was not involved, as you've just pointed out, but there are equally now unfolding many good reasons why he might very well have been involved.
There's
a fairly developing, stronger case that there's more than one person involved, that there's a group involved in this murder and other murders. I mean, we don't know enough yet to really say to you, this is my theory, this is what happened. I can't say that. You know, I'm devoted to the forensic side of this, not to conclusions, but rather to evidence. and the evidence is some evidence points in that direction. And Pack is not completely off the hook. Okay. You know, look, why does Shannon go from Jersey City to Manhattan to Oak Beach for a $300 tryst in one night when she's a fairly high-class level sex worker and $300 is not a lot of money to meet her rent, and she's living in a fairly nice place. And she goes at that time of the morning all the way out to Oak Beach in unfamiliar territory for only $300.
Because she wanted to get a gift for her mother. She wanted to get a gift for her mother.
That may be, but it's a hell of a lot easier to get $300 in Manhattan than to drive all the way to Oak Beach and come back. And her driver is driving an SUV, and he's willing to take that trip for $50. That doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Okay? That's just not rational. Unless there's more to the origin. Not one of you knows, not the police, not you, not I, knows the true origin of the connection with Joe Brewer and Oak Beach, why she was there that night, except from Joe Brewer's mouth and Alex Diaz's mouth. And
okay.
You can't trust.
I will just say, just from my experience with sex workers driving them around on Long Island, I've seen them do a lot more for a lot less.
You're talking about bottom feeders. You're not talking about a girl who is trying to break into the high-end East End market of rich, wealthy men. One of her clients was Mr. Jimmy Bissett. Another client was a multimillionaire in Kings Park, Long Island.
Wait, she was familiar with Long Island.
Okay,
let's not just go
and say that she's some kind of a bottom feeder that's doing tricks for $300. That's not true.
All I suggested is that I've seen other people do other things for less. But you said something that was very important. Are you going on the record and stating that she was a client of James? Sorry, that James Bissett was her client. Do we have proof?
Yes, according to my eyewitness, she was a client of James Bissett. Yes.
Okay.
And she was a client of a wealthy man in the Kings Park area with a multi-million dollar home. And she worked the hotels in by the Nassau Coliseum and also the Garden City Hotel. And she was working very hard to break into the East End wealthy man's market. So, and of course, that makes sense when you consider that she was busted when she belonged to a ring in New Jersey. So she got away from New Jersey after the bust, and she was working Long Island. So the idea that she was some kind of an innocent prostitute who went onto the internet and found some guy in a remote Oak Beach and would do a $300 trick for at 3 o'clock in the morning doesn't start to make a lot of sense when you consider what I've just told you. It might.
Okay.
You may be right, but you also
may be
wrong.
All right, John. I love speaking to you. It's great, and you provide a lot of fodder for us to continue this investigation, but we do have to move on to AC.
I know.
Our conversation is not done yet.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.
We're going to have you on again real soon. John Ray, the family attorney.
Please don't be mad at me. I can't help what I do. That's what I do.
That's okay.
Right.
You're doing your job, and that's what counts, right?
I respect what you're doing and your friends. So good.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, bye now.
Okay, we are going to move on to Atlantic City, Eastbound Strangler. This is four women found dead behind the motel in Egg Harbor. And we do have Mark Mueller on the phone. So if you would like to go directly to Mark, we can set that up right now. Or should we just do a little background first? Okay, Mark Mueller, welcome to the show. We appreciate you coming on to Web Sleuth Radio. You've recently written an article, which is, I'm sure, the reason that they desperately wanted you on the show tonight, and you're here, and we appreciate it, Mr. Mueller. Thank you.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
Hi.
Hey,
good,
Mark.
Thanks. Hi.
Thanks very much for your coverage. We were excited to, you know, I'll be honest. Excuse me. We've been speaking to a lot of people and really hoping that with our coverage, something would come out of Atlantic City. Has it?
Well, here's what we've got in Atlantic City. We've got what seems to be a very stalled investigation. What I was able to get from a law enforcement official who was involved in the investigation were some pretty interesting details about the early days of the investigation, and many of these details were never before published. But before I even go there, after my story ran on Sunday, I got a call. Finally, I'd been looking for this woman for years, and I got a call from her, the woman who found Kim Raffo's body, one of the four women who was killed. And 6 years ago, 8 years ago, I'd been trying to find her, and she has a very common last name. Her name is Rose Diaz. But she told me this fascinating story about finding the body, how they almost never found these bodies. So she was very pregnant, and she was instructed by her doctor to go take walks. And she and her friend were taking a walk, and her friend spied a little purplish flower on the bank of the canal where this body was. And she said, oh, I have to have the flower. I have to have the flower. So Rose bends down on her knees and reaches for the flower, and that's when she sees the body of Kim Raffo. And if she hadn't reached for that flower, perhaps these women never would have been found. Just an interesting little detail. There were some other interesting things that that came up from this law enforcement official I spoke to, which was a day before her death, Raffo was actually with a customer, a North Jersey doctor, and he had been staying at the Trump Taj Mahal, which is now closed. And at about 5 a.m. on November 19th, they were found on November 20th. She told him she was going out to get some drugs and would be back. She wasn't back. And after a while, he started calling her cell phone, and he never got a response. So police did find this doctor through her cell phone records, and they ultimately cleared him of suspicion because there were, you know, there's lots of cameras in casinos and hotels, and the surveillance footage apparently confirmed his account that Raffo went out and didn't come back. They did also find that his calls to her were routed to a cell tower on the Black Horse Pike. That's that desolate little highway where all these low-rent motels are, where they were found. But they didn't at that point know if Raffo was alive or dead. They also said that Raffo had no defensive wounds on her body. So does that mean she was drugged? Does that mean she was asleep, somehow incapacitated another way? She certainly wasn't tied up because that would have left marks on her body. But she apparently offered little to no resistance when she was strangled. And Tracy Roberts, who died right before Raffo, also had no discernible defensive wounds. So it's interesting to see what the MO was here. I would love to know how he got these girls, who are pretty street smart, got them to trust him. Was it someone they knew? Was it a longtime drug dealer? You know, we don't know. Certainly the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office is not telling us a whole lot about this case.
Right. Can I ask, that remains consistent with the fact of that, in my eyes, remains consistent with what we know, that basically each woman was kind of plied with their drug of choice or alcohol, whatever, and if it's one thing we've learned from our research, you know, that drugs are always part of this.
Yeah, it's always the common denominator.
It's right, you know, and it's, you know, we're dealing with addiction issues, and that's not to blame these victims. We're just saying this is how it happened, and basically, you know, you're plying somebody full of drugs over and over again, and, you know, it becomes very easy. They're high. They're really high. Now, I wonder, knowing that she left the Taj to go to what we're going to assume to be Black Horse Pike, to the Golden Key, we know that that was a common place for a lot of women to go get drugs.
Right.
So is this consistent, and this is something we didn't cover in the case, but something I want to bring up, is this consistent with the idea that Kim was partying in room 101, which, you know, another sex worker named Pam Cavelli has also tried to, talk about that. Does that lead us to believe that Room 101 does play a prominent part in this?
Based on my conversations with the law enforcement official, we can't go that far. They don't know that Kim Raffo was killed in the Golden Key Motel in Room 101. They the authorities believe, you know, there are a dozen little flop houses out there that you can get, at the time you could get a room for $15-$20 a night. And they believe she could have been killed at any one of those flop houses, or she could have been killed someone else and just dumped there. Now, the bodies were found so close to the Golden Key. I mean, Kim was found directly behind it, and the other women a couple hundred yards east. So that's a natural progression to look there. My law enforcement official told me one real problem with this investigation was that, so they find the bodies, they search, they do a cursory search of every single room in the Golden Key, but they don't do a forensic search of room 101 for like a month afterward.
Whoa.
So anybody...
Wow.
So
wow.
any trace detail likely would have been vacuumed up. I mean, the room had been, you know, people had moved in, people had moved out. The room had been cleaned.
Sure.
You know, however poorly it'd be cleaned. But
The
fact that there was such a delay in doing a forensic search of that room, it really didn't yield much of anything.
Well,
now, I have a question about the crime scene. Mark, we've continued to hear speculation that the crime scene behind the Golden Key, they found Kim, right? She's right behind.
Right.
And then they closed they opened the crime scene up, but then they ended up finding the next three victims and then again closed the crime scene, and therefore there was a tainted crime scene. Have you heard much about this?
You know, all I remember hearing about, I don't know the specifics that you know, but what I do remember hearing is that there were people tromping all over the place when they found Kim's body. And there was some worry about lost evidence or contaminating evidence. But I don't know in the end that really hurt the investigation, because I think they'd been in the water so long, there wasn't that much, especially in the case of the first three. They'd been in the water so long
that
DNA had been washed away, trace evidence had been washed away. Because even though it's a little bit stagnant, when it rains, that canal moves. And it can really scrub a body of anything valuable.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Well, look, that totally makes sense. I guess I was trying to find out. Well, I guess that does indicate, at least if nothing else, knowing that she left at 5 o'clock in the morning, knowing that the cell phone tower was pinged to Black Horse Pike, that she was at least on the pike.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
okay.
And it would lead me to believe that she, you know, I can't say this with certainty, but it would lead me to believe she was alive when she was on the pike, who knows for sure. Anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No. And now, there was another show, and we can ask John Kelly about it. Maybe we should say that for Dark Minds. Anything else? There were actually a couple of different things that you uncovered. Can you tell us those two?
Yeah, one of the other things is Raffo did have DNA under her fingernails, but they could not tell if it was, you know, it wasn't like skin scrapings, like from a defensive kind of fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was DNA, though, and they could not tell if she had just gotten it in casual contact. It matched no one in any law enforcement databases. The law enforcement official that I spoke with was pretty critical of the way the investigation was set up. For one thing, the prosecutor's office was very, very hesitant to label this the work of a serial killer. You've got a town based on tourism. You've got guys going down there not just to gamble but also to sample the prostitutes. It sounds crude, but that's true. And they did not want to spark a panic. And so it would be many months before they even said, yeah, we probably think it is because there are so many similarities. So they set up these investigators into four separate teams and had each team investigate each killing as if it were a separate case. And what that did basically is teams were going over the same ground that other teams had already done. They were bumping into each other. They were running into witnesses who said, but I just spoke to you guys. You know, and they did have meetings every day. But there were, you know, the conversations weren't as fluid as they should be, and the information sharing wasn't as fluid as they should be. But, you know, my law enforcement official who spoke to me for this story is a guy with decades of experience on the homicide and other squads, and he said he had never seen an investigation like this, and he called it the fatal mistake for the investigation.
And again, it's so interesting to me. We're talking about a city that sells sanctioned sex. It's something that we say in the show. And you know, it's just not sexy to have four dead sex workers when you're trying to sell Atlantic City as a place to, you know, what stays in Atlantic, you know, what happens in Atlantic City stays in Atlantic City. That type
right.
of thing.
Right, right.
That's just tragic.
Yeah.
That's truly tragic. Anything else you want to share?
Let me think. Oh, yeah, there's one last thing that that my official was critical about the investigation. So you've got this trove of vice investigators in Atlantic City who are used to dealing with these women who work the street. They never brought those guys in. You know, the crime was committed just over the border in Egg Harbor Township. And because of that, so for weeks you had Egg Harbor Township and prosecutor's office investigators looking into the crimes. You had all these vice officers who regularly work with these women who could work their contacts, and they didn't ask them to join the investigation. And the vice guys got a little pissed off about
it. Yeah,
we interviewed
one of them who said that exact same thing.
Ah, right, right.
In the show.
And then they had a mass retirement, you know, and Atlantic City was sort of purging, and they had a mass retirement, and then you lost collectively a ton of knowledge about the streets of Atlantic City.
Right. Such a shame. Mark, great investigating. We're excited that this is coming back. You know, it's interesting. Every time this happens, a little bit more information comes out.
Right, right.
And so what do we do next? How do we get more information? How do we get Atlantic County Prosecutor's Office to continue to work with the community?
Well, you would think – I'm a little surprised the Atlantic County Prosecutor's Office hasn't really been more vocal about urging people to come forward with information. And I know we are 10 years out, and, you know, that's kind of a long shot. But, I don't understand why they don't put out a reward. I know, you know, there has been a reward put out by I guess, John Kelly, right? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yes, correct.
And, but I don't understand why the prosecutor's office doesn't add a little to that and say, please, we'd like to, you know. Because the people who would respond to that reward most likely are the people who were there on and around Pacific Avenue at that time and would be most likely to see something, or the people who were staying in the hotels on the Black Horse Pike. But they've never done that. You know, I wanted to ask them if they would retest the DNA found under Raffo's fingernails, because we've got more extensive testing capabilities these days. Maybe they would find something. And maybe they have done that, but they, you know, they just won't talk about the case at all, except that they're still investigating it. So certainly there are things maybe they are doing or things they could be doing. And I know there's a lot of frustration among the family members that the appearance, at least, is that they're not doing as much as they should be doing.
Yeah. Well, you know, I have to say, and Rach could probably speak to this more, but the most emotional we've ever been doing this whole show was speaking to Jeremiah.
Oh, I believe it. I believe it. His grandfather put me on with me too, and I wasn't expecting it. I was shocked. And when the kid told me she's in a better place and that a bad man killed her, totally heartbreaking. Heartbreaking.
Yeah, and you know, one thing that we didn't include in the series, just for time's sake, is that Jeremiah so intelligently expressed how difficult it is for these kinds of cases to be solved. You know, I think a lot of people don't understand stranger upon stranger crime is one of the most difficult crimes to solve, but a 10-year-old knew how difficult a case like this would be to solve, which is just staggering.
I mean, think about it. Like, you know, it really was. Like, and you knew he had been, like, watching these, like, Discovery ID shows. You knew he had, you know, trying to kind of understand what was going on. And this is, like, the information that he had told us. And, like, it was so tragic, man. I lost it. I totally lost it. I did, too, you know. Well, Mark, thanks for coming on. I think
thank
great
you so much.
Work.
My pleasure. It was really nice talking to you guys, and I'm really enjoying the series, so thanks for doing it.
Thank you, sir.
Okay,
thank
have a great
you.
Night.
You too.
And that
Bye-bye.
Was Mark Mueller, he writes for NJ.com, has a great article. You've got to read it if you're interested in
Absolutely.
Any of these killings, even if you're not,
mm-hmm.
just to get some great information. Getting Away with Murder, The Atlantic City Prostitute Killings 10 Years Later. That's NJ.com. Wow, he had some great stuff. That,
yeah, and
that
I just want to say is that it's really interesting that new information is still continuing to come out a decade later. So, you know, it's not too late to shed light on these, what some people might assume are cold cases.
Totally.
Absolutely right. And let's go to a woman now who knows a lot about these cases.
Mm-hmm.
Linda Cohen, she's a reporter for Atlantic City .com. And Linda, welcome to Web Sleuth Radio. We have Josh and Rachel on the line with you.
Hi, how you guys doing?
Hey, Linda.
Good, Linda. How are you?
Hi, Linda.
Okay, Linda, you've written extensively about these killings. Do you have any information? What have you found out that in the last year or so that maybe perhaps we don't know yet?
Well, I am here. I have heard that, while I didn't hear what Mark did about, you know, four different investigations basically
mm-hmm.
going on, there have been the different investigators all kind of had their own person that they thought did it. There were different
mm-hmm.
suspects for each one. Each is kind of convinced this is the person who did it, and they just didn't have enough evidence to charge anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did have an investigator actually say, yes, you know, Terry Olson, who you guys had on the show,
mm-hmm.
had always said, you know, he was never really named a suspect. The investigator I spoke to said, of course he was, you know, I don't know what we called him, but of course he was a person of interest. He was staying in the hotel at the time. He was accused and convicted of a perverted act in taping his then girlfriend's underage daughter. So
mm-hmm.
there were kind of things that gave possibly he was a suspect. So, you know, while they never charged him and no one ever officially called him a suspect, in the minds of the investigators, he was one of several.
But Linda, how did they account for the fact that the guy offered his DNA? I mean, if you're guilty, that
right.
would not be the smart thing to do.
Right. Unless he knew that, you know,
come on.
There
you
wasn't
know what
enough
I'm
there or, you know, right.
It just doesn't make sense to me. Like, that would be a real
right.
game of roulette, you know?
Right.
And, you know, it's sorry, folks, but killing is not like CSI. You know, you're not that good. No one's that good.
Right.
So it's amazing. Now, listen, what are you most surprised at hearing what Mark's uncovered?
It was interesting that there were, you know, as you had ex-Captain Hutchins on talking about how they never had Vice in there, one of the investigators I spoke to was actually a little perturbed, I guess, is the right word for that portion, because he said, we did have Atlantic City Police investigating it. We had Atlantic City Police assigned to major crimes, so they were investigating it. They did have, at one point, 50 investigators on this case. So he was
sure.
kind of a little upset that it may have looked like, oh, well, they weren't putting the proper resources on it. They weren't asking the right people to look into it, that maybe, you know, because of, you know, there was some belief that because of what these women did for a living, that it didn't matter as much, and that wasn't the case. And he was kind of upset about that, I guess.
Right. Well, can I ask you, listen, I don't think we're saying that, or
right.
I don't even think Hutchins was
right.
saying that they weren't. I think he's saying,
right.
you know, we're talking about the golden time, you know, that
right.
the three
right.
days. You know,
right.
and I think, you know, knowing what Marcus said, you know, that there was another
right.
person who said it, and who knows, it could be the same individual, you know,
right.
with the same
mm-hmm.
axe to grind. But I think we can all say, you know, we all know that this, you know, those hours are so critical.
Right. Well, that was the whole thing in identifying them, and that had been Hutch's problem at that point, because I talked to him back then. And he said, you know, three of the four women, one of the detectives who worked the street, she knew them. So she
right.
would have been able to identify them if she had been brought in. That was his argument at that time, and I guess continues to be, that because the crucial thing is once you identify them, the quicker you identify the victims, the quicker
totally.
You can trace them and see where they've been, and the farther away you get. And I know you were talking about them reopening the crime scene. That was another thing that, and it was days later. It wasn't even, because it was weird. It was like we had been covering it, and then all of a sudden you went by the Golden Key, and the police tape was back up, and they were on the roof, and they were in the back, and I think I told you guys we had a photographer who said, "Well, my DNA's back there now. I was smoking a cigarette back there," it was interesting. And I know that you guys, which, I always say to people as far as the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office, when they say, they're not saying anything, why is there this ulterior motive? Because you did kind of find that in the other case that there was a reason of the foot dragging. But I always say to people, welcome to the Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office, because this is the legacy of Jeff Blitz. And, who was the prosecutor at the time. And this is just something he's passed down that you don't talk. And the investigator I spoke to will still insist on that. He'll say, well, this isn't about making an arrest. This is about getting a conviction. And if we put too much out there, we're going to dirty the jury pool and we're not going to get a conviction. And that's the most important thing. But, of course, people like you guys looking for an answer are saying, well, at least find who did it, And if that means putting some more information out there that will spark someone, then that's the thing you should be doing.
I two schools of thought. Listen, we don't want to continually throw law enforcement under the bus. What we want to do is spark a conversation and say, hey, here's a couple cases that didn't get solved. Don't you think it's time that we maybe release some information? And I get it. It's not about the arrest; it's about the conviction. Especially for a prosecutor's office, I get that. But at the same time, and one thing we didn't bring up, and this was not planned, by the way, 2 days ago was the 10th anniversary. Not planned at all on our end, but that's what happened. Mm-hmm. After 10 years, are you that – yes, you are still concerned about a conviction, but conviction of what? Nothing's happening. No one's going to walk into your office and be like, I did it.
Right.
And
that's the thing. If you put a little bit, maybe there's something that they didn't put out that they don't even realize would spark someone, would say, oh, wait, I saw this. And it's something that you wouldn't even think is connected to it. I know that is also why they have over the years put new detectives on it, because they do that with cold, they've never liked to call this one a cold case, but they do that with cold cases, that you get a new set of eyes on it. You look at different things, you find out, it leads you somewhere else and maybe you can find a new piece of evidence. But they haven't, like you guys said, there was one press conference and it was before the other three women were even categorized as homicide. That's the really interesting part of it. So we talk about how Blitz was never wanted to put that serial killer label on it. He didn't even wait until they were all categorized homicides to have a press conference and talk about it.
Right. So why do you not want to say – I mean, I know, but I want to hear your answer. Why do you not say – why did he not want to say serial killer? You have four women found in a ditch, all kind of, the graveyard staging, the whole nine yards. Why do you not say it?
And I think it was to not, spark panic, make it, oh, my God, there's this serial killer out there. I think – it was easier to say, okay, we have four people. That was a huge thing in this area anyway. I mean, you don't have four people wind up dead somewhere in this area. This isn't, something you see. This was huge for this area. It's something that's remembered because of four women found dead. So you don't want to even put a bigger label on that. I know that Blitz was always very careful in how he proceeded with things, so part of it could have been that. But I'm sure there was more to it had them all categorized that way. You had one asphyxiated and one strangled. While you didn't know how the other two died, you knew they were all in the same profession. You knew that they all had similar vices. And so obviously there was a type here.
But the press is the one who likes to, push the buttons and sell newspapers, right? That's why they say serial killer, right? But As a law enforcement or as a prosecutor, don't you – isn't it part of the public service to say, hey, everybody, hey, sex workers in Atlantic City, which is kind of – you know, we're not going to deny that there's sex workers around Atlantic City. Hey, be careful. Aren't they supposed to do that?
And that's the thing, and they never did. And they – And that's something they have done. They've tried to just downplay any kind of the sex workers, the violence, anything. Because if you look, I mean, I've been told cops tried to do a series in Atlantic City, and they didn't want them there. They don't want to have anything on, you know, they don't want to draw attention to any part of the negative side. I think because a lot of times the city did take some hits even when it wasn't negative. I think the city feels like it's been bullied a long time, so they feel like it's put even under a bigger, more of a microscope when bad things happen. So they kind of, to get it even again, they go the other way.
Right.
If that makes sense.
Right. But, no, that makes sense. But you know, it's like, hey, you know, you have gambling. You know, you have legalized gambling. You know, you got to take the hit on the other side.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, sorry.
And that's the whole thing. And they've had before, what people do forget too is that before the four women showed up, there were two women separately
right.
that were found dead that were prostitutes in other places in Atlantic City.
Right.
And
not related
there had
to the
been
case,
questions,
we know.
Was it, you know, but so that was one of the, that was at one point questioned, was that him when he first started, is that what he did, you know? And any time a woman shows up dead that way now, everybody's like, oh, is he back? Is this, you know, and the prosecutor's office, of course, doesn't address it at all, just like with the Joyce Vanderhoff case that you
well,
talked
I've,
about.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the first things. I know you guys didn't really connect it. You just were looking at it as another unsolved case here and, you know, who killed this woman. But I got emails all the time of people, don't you think that this is the same person who killed those four women? There was another woman whose remains were found in a suitcase a few months before Joyce was found, and she was naked in suitcase, and
right.
it was, oh, well, you know, this, aren't you seeing all these women are showing up dead again? This is, you know, so you have two ends of the spectrum. You have one where everybody's trying to connect everything, and the other one where they waited to even say it was a serial killer. So, and
right,
they waited
right.
actually a while till they said what was in their systems as well. I know we know now that they each had the drugs that were in their system were drugs that they were known to have used. So did
right.
this
right.
person just kind of party with them and keep giving them drugs until they were incapacitated and then killed them? Or, you know, and I know I heard you guys brought up Pam Cavelli, who spoke a long time ago. I don't know if you guys tried mm-hmm. to track her down or anything, but I know right after
we did.
that kind of became public, she got really scared and
right.
didn't want to talk about anything at all. And I know, like with Melissa Bishop as well, you know,
yeah.
I know you tracked her down, but
yep.
I know she didn't. I mean, in her mind, she is convinced it's Terry
yeah.
Olson, and in Denise
mm-hmm.
Hill's mind, she's convinced that it's not. So,
right. Well, I you know, listen, we don't want to drag Terry through the mud.
Right.
You know,
no.
obviously, you know, we do want to track down
right.
the persons of interest.
And he has always
and
been very open, like you said.
He
you
has.
Know, and you
has.
Do feel bad for him because he lost all of this. He hasn't been convicted of anything. He never got the stuff back that they took from him, which doesn't
mm-hmm.
seem fair because if you're even if they think he did it, they obviously don't have enough to charge him. So why should they be able to keep the things that they took from him? That, you know, and he lost a lot in that becoming so public.
It's very tragic.
He's
you know, I feel
the only
bad
one that anybody ever heard named for it, even though there were other people. And the investigator I spoke to doesn't believe it's Terry. He believed that he was a suspect at the time, but it's not necessarily, you know, that wasn't the person he had kind of hung it on.
Is it responsibility
so.
Of law enforcement to say this person is no longer a suspect? Like, isn't there the human side of this?
Right.
Isn't there the human
well,
side?
Well, that's what we kept saying. We said, listen, you know, you took the guy's DNA. It was very public that they took the DNA, that they, I mean, when he was arrested for what he was arrested for, the bail just screamed, this isn't why he's got this bail. We knew at that time, as soon as we saw the bail, hey, this guy's a suspect in this case. And but the prosecutor's office has always been adamant in that we've never named him a suspect, so how can we clear him? And I know that's been very upsetting to Terry. It's been very upsetting to his fiancée.
Mm-hmm.
She's, I think it's been more upsetting to her because that's the man she loves. She trusts him. She believes he's a good person. They've been together all this time. She was there from the beginning. I mean, I remember her picking him up. We were the only the photographer I was with and I were the only ones there when he was released from the Salem County Jail when he had first been arrested, and she was there for him. You know, so they've been in this the whole time. It wasn't like, it's not even one where things got rough and she went away. Things got rough and she came to him, and she's been there for him. So they have a really good relationship. And for her, there's no doubt in her mind that he had nothing to do with this.
Well, thank you again for everything that you've done. Your coverage has been great. I want to apologize that we did not get to include you in the series, because you are great, and hopefully we can make it up to you by talking with you and bringing you on now. But everybody should read your blog about the case. Can you just give everybody a little bit of information about that?
It's called BreakingAC.com, and I have some stuff on that, and I'm actually going to be doing some more things because since, you know, this has come up again, people are, you know, reaching out and talking about different angles that can be taken. I'm going to be talking to a DNA expert about ideas that he has of how they would be able to solve cases like this even years later. So there's going to be more stuff coming up that I'm trying to do.
Great.
And I'm continuing to watch your series. And I know we got a lot of really good feedback when I was tweeting along when we were watching, and you know, a lot of people were really interested in the case because they do wonder what happened. People around here do care, and they were, you know, they've been upset about it. So it's not like these women weren't throwaway to people here. People did not, you know, think less of them or anything like that. People have been, they do get brought up, like I said, whenever there's a woman found dead and she may have been a prostitute or had drug problems, there's always people bringing the women back up and why haven't they solved this case yet. So it isn't just on the anniversary for people around here, although we may not write about it all the time. There is always, you know, people do remember.
Good, good. Well, thank you for that, and we appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Thank you, Linda. By the way, I would recommend people follow Linda on Twitter. She's absolutely fascinating. It's at Linda, that's LYNDA Cohen, LYNDACOHEN on Twitter. You will find her tweets absolutely fascinating. John, we're going to go now to John Kelly, one of my favorite people, and Josh and Rachel, we're going to talk about a big reward that John Kelly, this is the first I've heard of it. So John Kelly, criminal profiler, welcome once again to Web Sleuth Radio, and you're on with Josh and Rachel.
Hey, Tricia, how are you? And hello to
Josh and Rachel and all the listeners.
Hey, John. Hope you're all well. Great. Fantastic. Yes. Great to be on.
Thanks, John. So tell us about this reward.
Well, we've decided a while ago, as you know, to put out a $25,000 reward, and we were hoping we'd, you know, get some feedback, which we have gotten, and we've sent over to law enforcement. And we're hoping that something comes of it, that somebody wants to claim the reward. And the way the reward is set up, it's for information leading to the arrest and conviction of any of the girls that were murdered behind the hotel. It doesn't have to be the arrest and conviction of the murderer of the four women. We will accept the arrest and conviction of any one of the girls that were murdered. We will give the reward to whoever brings us a murderer for any one of the girls. $25,000. We will sign it right over to them.
That's amazing. And it's amazing, A, that you were able to kind of pool that money. And
what was the response from law enforcement about that? I mean, that's got to be a great help to them.
Well, we've sent it over to them, and you know, we're just we get information, we email it over, and they're accepting it. I mean, I'm not getting calls from law enforcement saying, you know, fantastic. I'm not getting any feedback really at all from law enforcement on the reward. They're just accepting the information.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, that's unfortunate, only because I think, as we were saying earlier, you know, that would really, $25,000 is not a small amount, and it's not a small amount for somebody to be motivated to say something, especially knowing the groups of people who these women were associating with.
Josh, you're absolutely correct. I mean, bottom line is somebody knows something, okay?
Right.
And we're dealing in a city where people need money for whatever, but also there's a lot of drug addiction going on. There's gambling going on. So you have people there to come and go through money pretty quickly.
Right.
You know, in the show, you and Rachel brought out the track, okay? I mean, there are people in that area that I'm sure know something. And why should they come forward if there's not a dime out there of reward for the deaths of these women? Do you realize there's no other reward out there and never has been except ours? I think maybe in the beginning, some, you know, they put $1,000 out, Crime Stoppers or something. But the bottom line is, I mean, you have four dead women, and there isn't a dime out there to give anybody any incentive to come forward.
Yeah, that's
frustrating. I mean, these were mothers, these were daughters.
Yeah.
I mean, these were, you know, sisters. I mean, you know, I mean, you know, thrown in a sewage ditch.
Yeah.
You know, like garbage.
Yeah. No.
Murdered and thrown in a sewer.
Can I
Somebody's
ask you something,
child?
John?
Yeah, sure,
you covered this case in your own show, Dark Minds, correct?
Oh yeah.
So there's something I want to bring up, and it's something that has another connection, interestingly enough, back to Long Island. One we didn't cover in the show because we couldn't, although we knew that Pam Cavelli, who's a local sex worker, had said something. Can you explain the storyline about the two guys in the van and this whole piece of information?
Well,
there
was a story floating around about two guys in a van, and these two guys in a van were partying consistently in, I guess, a motel room, you know, off in that seedy kind of hotel motel area at the time. And there was speculation that I did not agree with that.
Okay.
They were partying there, and people were getting killed, and bodies were actually piling up in this room.
Right.
And this, you know, and this was going on for a number of weeks, and then all of a sudden these bodies were taken out and dumped behind the Key Motel. Well,
was the room 101?
It was at some other motel where this party was going on, but then supposedly three of these girls were then hauled away in a van and dumped behind the Key Motel. Now, I didn't agree with that, and I'm going to tell you why. Because I don't care how much of a party you got going on for a few weeks or a month, and how much you know you're drinking,
right,
or how many drugs you're doing. You know, the smell of bodies rotting is going to be unbearable in a room. Okay,
and
we also know by the decomposition of these girls, the way their bodies decompensated, that, you know, I mean, or decomposed, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I guess you could go either way with it. But anyway, you know, you're looking at probably a week in between each one. So they weren't all hauled over there at the same time.
Mm.
I just have a hard time with it.
Sure, sure. So two questions.
Yeah.
Do you believe anybody was killed in the Golden Gate?
I do. I believe at the very least Kim Raffo was.
Right.
And I believe, as you know, that her body was found directly in back of
right.
the Golden Key and not down with the other cluster of bodies. So we've got three bodies, as you're well aware of, down the road,
right,
away from the hotel,
right,
spaced, what, 50, 60 feet apart in the drainage ditch?
Right.
Mm-hmm. And how come Kim Raffo didn't get to go down there? What
right.
happened?
And so she was found very different from the others, is what you're saying.
Yes, she was found directly in back of the hotel. And she was still in the ditch, but she was right in back of the hotel as if somebody, for whatever reason, whether the sun was coming up or whatever, for whatever reason, they were in a rush. She got killed in that hotel is what I believe, and they didn't have time to transport her down to the graveyard that they had started down below and deposit her with the
Kim
other victims.
But how far was Kim from the others?
I'd say, you know, I'd only be guessing, Josh, but I got to say probably 100 yards. I'm guesstimating. Mm-hmm. I never paced it
right.
off. You guys right. know better than I do probably when it comes to
yeah.
that. I never paced it off. I'm just looking at her directly behind the hotel, okay?
Right.
And I'm looking at the other ones numerically positioned down
right.
below. You had 1, 2, 3, and Kim should have been 4. Kim goes directly in back of the hotel. Why? If this guy doesn't want to get caught, if he's trying to keep the bodies away from being seen by the hotel or the stench
mm-hmm.
of their corpses rotting in this sewage ditch from the hotel, why does he deposit one directly behind the hotel? I mean, it's only a matter of time.
Right.
And didn't take too long for her
right.
to be discovered.
36 hours, right. So
there it is.
And so maybe he, you know, his time was done there. He was moving on.
I agree with you.
Okay.
Whoever did this knew those bodies were going to be found, and he was going to be on his way out of town. Now, here's another question, okay, and I think everybody might be interested in. Supposedly, these girls were found without any shoes or socks, but yet
mm-hmm.
pretty much clothed, from what I know, from the waist down, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So why are they clothed? Why didn't he take their clothes? Because, see, this enters into your DNA question. If they were abused from the waist down and then their pants were put back on,
right,
that would give the DNA some type of protection through the elements. Do you follow me?
Right. So you're saying there was no sexual abuse?
Well, I'm saying it's pretty strange, and I've been looking for 10 years, and I can't find another case throughout the country where the women are clothed and they don't have any shoes or socks on, and the guy's
right.
a sexual killer.
Right.
So,
right.
I mean, this is really a very, very bizarre and interesting case or cases, if you want to look at it. I mean, it's
right.
just, you know, you would assume if he had some kind of intercourse with these girls as well, there would be some kind of DNA on the lower extremities of their bodies, and if it was
right.
covered over by pants, it would have been protected to a certain point through these elements.
Right.
So
right,
do they have DNA? Do they not have DNA? Did you know, this person have some kind of, you know, sex with the lower part of their body? Or was this just about the upper part of their body, which he put in the water, which would have, you know, contaminated and washed the DNA away?
Right.
And just killed them.
Right.
Or
so was this an upper extremity sexual kind of thing and a foot fetish and a murder? because I just can't understand why there wouldn't be any DNA if it was protected by their pants.
Okay.
Or right. Undergarments.
Well, John, again, you are a real fighter for not just, you know, looking at this case, but getting people to put up $25,000. It truly, that is commendable. And I want to thank you for that, because it's individuals like you who, you know, citizens who will help solve this case. So thank you.
Well, I truly appreciate that, Josh. And I have to thank all of you guys, Web Sleuths, Josh and Rachel, The Killing Season, Jigsaw and Alex Gibney, because if you guys weren't out there getting the word out on the slaughter and disappearance of these women throughout the country and giving voices to the dead and to their families, there would be nobody out there championing this cause. And this is
right.
This is going national, and I can't commend you enough for it.
Well, thank you, John. Mm. All
thank
right,
you.
Guys. Well,
John,
thank
I
you.
Have, I, excuse me.
Go,
I have
please.
One quick question from somebody. This person has been waiting since the beginning of the show. And, John, maybe you can answer this for us, okay? It's really
okay.
quick here. Were the victims placed in the water because they would decompose faster, or is there a psychological reason behind all of this water?
Well, that's an excellent question, because, you know, water lots of times is used in religious rituals, and then you have the women facing east. Was that just the current of the water that forced them that way? Was it something religious, why he wanted them facing east towards the Holy Lands? Was it something ominous that he wanted them facing east towards Atlantic City? But I will tell you, one of my feelings is that he had them in the water from the torso down, from their hips on land, but the rest of their body in the water, and I really believe that was also to wash away DNA.
Right. That makes sense. I do want to say that, you know, there's been a lot of talk about Muslim and things like that. And while I don't want to rule anything out, you know, we did go speak to a local imam, and you know, he gave us some really very interesting insight. You can actually go on A&E's website and see that additional content, and I really recommend it for all those people to see. But guys, thank you all very much. John, thanks again, much appreciated.
Thank you so much, and all you guys have a great holiday, and all you listeners out there, thank you so much. Have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you,
take
John.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Now, we have episodes 5 and 6 coming up this Saturday on A&E. Where are we going with these episodes? This is great. I mean, it's just you're going everywhere and bringing all of this new information, and you just got to love it.
Well, I mean, we just go, as Rachel always says, we just go down the rabbit hole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, we've gone to Long Island. We've gone to Atlantic City. Now we're heading to Daytona. And it doesn't stop there, you know. I think as we continue, there's 8 episodes, as we continue down that rabbit hole, we pull the lens out and we stop being as granular and specific at looking at specific cases, which is extremely important. But we pull that lens out and we talk about these cases in a bigger societal manner, which is extremely important.
Specific. But then you also do go back specific.
We
don't want to say too much. Rach, can I say this, that out of all the episodes, everybody says 6 is the best?
6 is my favorite, that's for sure.
But everybody says 6 is the craziest.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, listen, I like shows that take a turn. And, you know, we're not just going to be asking questions and tracing down, you know, things that have no resolution. Let's put it like that. 6 gets nuts. And by the way, guys, we don't know if A&E is going to put 5 and 6 in front or behind the firewall. So please watch 5 and 6 because of what happens in 6. And I think our live tweeting is going great, so I can't wait to kind of continue with that.
And I do encourage everyone, this is a great week for you to pull your family, pull your friends into binge watching this series. You know, there's nothing like having a big turkey sandwich and sitting on the couch and getting really immersed in something like this.
Right.
I know I'll be watching the episodes again.
And
Josh, when you say...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you say episode 6 won't be behind the firewall, you mean A&E may not be putting that up there for everybody to see. So
after.
It's a good...
Yeah.
After the show. So you should watch it. Not
right.
Depend on it being on A&E's site. Okay, thank you.
Right. No, it probably will be on A&E's site, but you may have to put in, like, your information or your cable provider. I'm not sure. You know, I'm not good with those things. But what I'll be very honest with everybody and be very serious for a moment, which is, I'm really happy that people are watching the show. I think we spent a lot of time on it. We were hoping that people would care about what we saw out there as much as we care and as much as getting to know these people and these families that have no answers and these women who have no justice. And it's really just not fair to be more than anything. So I want to ask people out there to share the story and share what we're doing. A&E, I love them. They're great, but it's at the end of the day, it's all about the numbers. For us, it's a lot more than that. And so if they can share, more people see it. If more people see it, more people care. And as you see, what we try and do is we try and make people care. We try and make people see these women as something. Mm-hmm. And so please share it. And I know Rach has something to add on to that.
Well, no, I just want to thank everyone, especially Web Sleuth.
Absolutely.
I've been on the site, and I can tell you that the participation, the engagement has been better than I've ever seen before. The amount of tips that I've been getting, the amount of engagement that I've been having, and the one-on-one conversations that I've had on WebSleuth and on Twitter. You know, I'm not much of a Twitter person, and I've had so many people, thankfully, follow me in the past 2 weeks. And I've had so many great conversations with people who are extremely interested in these cases from a very personal standpoint, have their own theories, but more importantly, just want to see, as Josh said, something happen with these cases. So I'm extremely thankful for those who are watching and are telling their friends and family to watch as well.
Well, thank you, Rachel. And on behalf, go ahead.
And I just want to say, please continue to share with your friends and family, especially during this Thanksgiving holiday, this series, because I think it is really important. And I think it does, as hokey as it sounds, it really does take a village.
It does. And Rachel, on behalf of Web Sleuths, we want to thank you and Josh for you've done all the groundwork, laid work, the sweat that it took to put this show together, and we're here behind you 100%. So thank you for having the insight to see that this needed to be done. Nobody else has ever done this before. You two came up with it, and I just have a good feeling that something is going to happen. There's going to be a resolution here. And thank you for coming up with the idea and bringing it to Web Sleuth. We can't thank you enough.
Thanks, guys. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you, everybody.
Take
care. Now, don't forget, Saturday, 8 p.m., The Killing Season. That's Eastern time. And then we'll be back next Tuesday and discuss episodes 5 and 6. Josh and Rachel, thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
It's
9 p.m. Eastern. 9 p.m.
Oh, I'm
sorry.
9 p.m.
I'm
sorry. My apologies. 9 p.m. Eastern.
It's all good.
8 central.
Oh, wait.
8 central.
Actually, you bring up a good point. Rach, are they going to show more episodes previous to
that's
the,
a question.
To 5 and 6?
I think they're I think they're probably going to show 3 and 4, so it probably starts at 7 Eastern, so 7, 8, 9, and 10. They've been doing a great A&E has been doing a great job at creating that kind of binge viewing. So I believe it'll start at 7, but the new episodes will start at 9 p.m. Eastern.
Yep.
Perfect. We'll talk to you next week. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks.
See you on WebSleuth.com.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.